This is the first in a series of interviews with Dr. Peter Greenwald, the director of the Division of Cancer Prevention, National Cancer Institute, on October 17, 2008, in his office in Bethesda, Maryland, about his career at the National Cancer Institute. The interviewer is Victoria Hardin. Dr. Greenwald, would you begin by stating your full name and that you're aware that we are recording this interview and that it's done with your permission?
Yes, my name is Peter Greenwald. I'm director of the Division of Cancer Prevention at the National Cancer Institute. I fully approve of this being recorded and appreciate your efforts in doing it.
Thank you. Now, you were born in Newburgh, New York on November 7th, 1936. Would you tell me some about your family and your early education through high school?
Yes. Newburgh is a small city. It was about 25,000 to 30,000, 60 miles north of New York on the Hudson River. I was actually born in the house where we lived with an aunt helping my mother deliver the baby. With that, they put in a box on a radiator. So I've heard that story many times. I have one older brother, very active, outgoing, I'll mention a little later, and two sisters, one younger. The three of us, my older brother Michael, sister Ruth, were close in age, and we have the same mother and father. We lived in Newburgh till about the fifth grade of elementary school.
Let me interrupt you and ask you to state your parents' names.
My father, Louis Greenwald, he was a pianist. We actually just opened, we found a book of newspaper articles from 1927 to 1928 when he toured the world with Ephraim Zimbalist, had wonderful reviews. He accompanied Melbourne, Australia, and went through the Far East and different places. He was very bright, very quick-witted, but had a sort of a sense of humor that was cutting that hurt people, unfortunately, like my sister's boyfriend. We were pretty free, riding our bikes, collecting butterflies, doing all sorts of things, went to the local schools. My mother was a...
Her name?
Pearl Rheingold was her maiden name, Greenwald. And they met in New York City through a cousin of my mother's. So the early part was fine, very outdoors. We did things like, you know, I don't think much of the National Rifle Association, but we were taught then how to put rifles over fences and do things. And I would never shoot at animals, but my brother would pick them off. But so then right after World War II, my father was fairly well off. A lot of people were at that period, but he was playing tennis a lot with another woman who was from the Breed group of Breed's Hill, whose family first came over in 1630. She was a very nice lady, very well educated, and actually very influential on me eventually because she knew about colleges and things. And my father, while he went to Juilliard by its previous name, didn't really, and my mother was just a very sweet, very pretty high school educated. Then about the fifth grade, we moved to New York. My mother and father had been not getting along that well, for reasons I never understood, but I think he fooled around with the other lady. They got divorced. That's when my other sister, Anne, who's 10 years younger, her mother is Frances. We're still very close. I mean, it's like we're the same mother and father, but it's technically different. And in New York, we lived on Central Park West and 93rd. I belonged to a gang. We saved our, for one example, some bigger kids tried to take our field playing ball, and I whacked one over the shins with a baseball bat, and the big kids took off. So I'd walk through the park at night because I took painting lessons, actually. There's a Y, YMHAWA, at the other side, on the east side of the park. So I'd walk around the reservoir, work home. People would worry about it. But it was before the real guns and knives kind of gangs. They were sort of tough, but not dangerous. I went to a junior high called Joan of Arc on 93rd Street, which later, I think, was cited for having the most drugs high schools in New York City, but at that time it was okay. And they always had, they tracked the kids that were better in math and science and things, so that was okay. And then I moved, there was 1 year I went to a private school because the principal lived on the same floor of our apartment house. So I got the scholarship to it. It's called Bentley School on 86th Street. It's very good. Eleanor Roosevelt spoke at the graduation. then I went back to Newburgh. We moved back for 2 years. But the schools there, they were good because New York State had regents, which were qualifying things. But they were behind where I was, so I skipped the 11th grade and then started college at age 16. At Colgate University.
When did you decide to go to Colgate?
It was when the standard time for applying was, would be, I think, in the fall of my senior year of college. And Frances Ann's mother, Frances Breed was her maiden name, she knew of Colgate because a number of her cousins went there. At that point, it was a boys' school, but it was a good college. My brother had gone to Cornell, and So then I majored in chemistry and physics.
We'll get back to Colgate in just a second. So what I'm hearing at this point is that within your family, your stepmother was a very important influence in terms of...
For academics. And a nice person. Yeah. So both. I mean, my mother, like when we moved to New York, she moved into the same building because she wasn't going to... apart from us, but and they would talk to each other. It wasn't exactly warm, but they would talk to each other. Yes, but Frances had a big influence because she had gone to Barnard. She was very well educated. She was a violinist, sort of a moderately talented violinist, but educated.
Did any of your family member encourage you to look at medicine, or did that come later?
No, that came later. No one did.
Who were your heroes? As a boy?
Gosh, you know, I don't really remember many. I mean, I knew the Yankee baseball players like DiMaggio and things. I don't remember any really in science. I kind of like math. On every Regents I took in high school, I always got 100%. But it wasn't a big deal. It's just, they were simple. I don't know, I looked up to my brother a lot. My brother was almost like a little engineer when he was little. We had a seaplane base in Newburgh, and without telling my parents, he would take lessons. He worked there in exchange for lessons, and he was a good pilot by the time he was in high school, and eventually went on to fly gliders, teach flying, fly, although he has all sorts of planes now. But he got to where he could take engines apart. And other than that, I mean, I knew of FDR. He came through our town a few times because Hyde Park isn't really that far away. It's north.
Did you have any high school teachers that were especially influential?
Well, it was a problem. I mean, I remember my geometry teacher, a tall fellow, because he knew I was getting bored and he let me teach a little to kind of keep my interest. And I remember the chemistry teacher who eventually became principal of the high school. But I was in the 10th grade, then I was in the 12th grade, so I didn't really have a class. I only remember one student from my class, Barbara. Now she's an associate dean at UCLA because she married the fellow who's now dean at UCLA. But she had taken piano lessons from my dad and lived a block and a half away, and she was a little older. But she went to Cornell and then came back to my medical school, already going out with this guy. But I would tease her. She'd get mad at me if I ran out and went to a party the day before a test, because she sort of felt responsible. And I'd tell everyone she used to babysit for me, because she was older.
I see.
So,
right, let's go back to Colgate now. You double majored in chemistry and physics.
Yeah.
Tell me about what at Colgate you see as important to the development of your career.
I think scientifically it was very solid. Socially, it wasn't too great. I thought there was anti-Semitism, actually, that was rooted in the fraternity system. And a lot of the fraternities, that was the center of a lot of the social life. So just in the way they selected. And then I never joined, although I'm not sure they really wanted me because I was more independent. But the courses were good. I liked the intramural sports were excellent. I liked living outdoors, and it's very outdoors in the hills, and being in things like the outing club. So that was good. So I liked the science, and I liked the outdoor and the environment. And some of the friends, but I only have very few friends from there, way more from medical school.
I'm just curious as to whether the fact that you skipped a grade and you were younger than most of the others had any influence on the
whole. I don't think it did there. I think it did in medical school, but I don't recall it in college being a problem. I was into math and physics. The biggest problem I had, which hurt my grades in the last year, was I went to two professors and wanted to take two courses that had labs in the same afternoon, which they approved, and then they both expected me to be there, and I couldn't be there. And then I thought, actually, even into my senior year, I was not thinking of medicine. I was thinking of physics, maybe. But you had to apply to medical school earlier in the year before you would apply for, say, a PhD. Mm-hmm. And so I applied for medical school. And I got in, I think the first one was Albany. We didn't think about going far away like people do today. Mm-hmm. You know, I was upstate. So I think the reason I got in Albany was because I built an oscilloscope, and when I went for the interview, the guy who interviewed me, the deputy dean, was very into electronic things, and he heard that, and that was right up his alley. And then I ended up going to Upstate, which is Syracuse, the State University of New York. Yeah. Medical School in Syracuse.
All right, so let's move on to medical school. Tell me about your training. I'm particularly interested in what sparked your interest in epidemiology and cancer, but your training in general.
Well, first, the school is very solid. I think one of the strongest periods it's ever had. There were some well-known people the year before me, like Sam Thier, who was at Mass General for years, having a lot of their training. So in general, it was solid. They were training a lot of clinical doctors. I remember in the first baby I ever delivered, you had to deliver 25, but I did more. But a young lady came in, the obstetrician didn't show up in time, so I was there with the nurse, delivered the baby, which was fine. And then the woman said, "Hello, Peter." And it turned out she was the wife of another medical student. That's what I remember. But she was fine. But I think the one, there were a couple people that influenced me. There was a fellow named Harry Feldman who would do vaccine studies, childhood vaccines. And because there was a low-income housing community right behind the medical school, and that was his lab. He would test out these vaccines. And the other one, even more important, was a pediatrician infectious disease expert named Paul Worley. It was between my third and fourth year of medical school. In the spring, maybe April or so, I forgot exactly when, I saw an ad that you could go anywhere in the world that you wanted, but you had to apply. It was something sponsored by the American Association of Medical Colleges and paid for by a company, SmithKline & Friends, that drug company. But you only had 2 weeks before the deadline. When I heard about it, it was almost the end. And it had to be a developing country. So I talked to Paul Worley, who I was very friendly with, and he said, "Oh, let me call his friend." His friend was James Halstead, a gastroenterologist who was FDR's son-in-law. He had married Anne Roosevelt. And he was taking a two-year stint in Shiraz, Iran, where there's a medical school. That medical school is largely, was at least then, related more to English and U.S. medicine, unlike Tehran, which is more related to French medicine. Just sort of the ties they have. So Halstead knew of, it was really a missionary doctor who would go around to these little villages as well as running his own little hospital. I said, oh, you can, well, can you arrange for me to spend the summer in this little village? So I went to Iran, and I actually went to the medical school a little bit. What impressed me compared to today was the medical students, girls and boys, men and women, were just like us, no covering, nothing, very open, and that was still under the Shah. And I had trouble picturing how they tolerated the change.
It changed after the revolution. Yeah.
But the experience I've done in that village, the landowner, who was a gypsy, had a tough guy whose tribe would come around with his village twice a year for 6 months and then go off and come back. He had built what they called as a hospital. It was a row of rooms made out of dirt, which is hard, like almost like brick. And there was a midwife there, and her husband, who was sort of they would run the hospital. And then this missionary guy would come around once a month. So I was the new doctor, but I didn't know anything. I just had 3 years of medical school. First patient had a scorpion sting, which I'd never seen. But just by luck, it just seemed logical. I treated the pain and things got better. And there was a lady with anthrax. It was awful. Let's say right under the left side of her lip, right between her chin and cheek, she had this cutaneous anthrax. But they had treated it, and the Persians called it a boil that must be boiled. So they put this clay thing molded with like a hole in the middle, a donut over it, poured in boiling oil, and what she really had was this huge burn.
Yeah.
But it cured the anthrax. And then I know it was in some of the sheep and goats and things. But and then there were lots of intestinal worms, parasites, some with obstruction that I had to send into Shiraz. Lots of drugs, but people came from all over thinking I was a foreign doctor, I must be good. And I was feeling, I didn't know anything.
You were getting all sorts of experience. Being exposed to things like seeing cutaneous anthrax stood you in good stead.
And a lot. There were some diabetics. There were a lot of conditions, and usually you could figure it out pretty easily. There were lots of drugs. There had been a 0.4 program, so they were stocked with things that probably shouldn't have even had there.
After you finished that, you went to Los Angeles for your internship.
Right.
Tell me about that year. What was important?
Well, first of all, it was L.A. County Hospital, which is a large charity hospital with lots of people with advanced disease, multiple disease, trauma, and I was one of the last in the era when people took rotating internships. So I spent a lot of time on surgery, obstetrics, orthopedics, pediatrics, psychiatry, as well as internal medicine. I thought that was good, that I learned a lot, and I think a lot of doctors miss out. Now they get so specialized they don't really have a good sense of the scope and how to treat a whole person, although some of that's come back. But
I've heard this from other people too, especially people who
so that was good.
The military.
The emergency room was like a combat zone. People, it was even one guy with ascites, liver problem, fluid, who came in with a bandana, so they sent him to obstetrics.
They didn't recognize. That must have been a surprise to the obstetrician.
They had a separate floor for diabetics with every disease they'd have, almost two services. They had a combination of a USC, which Paul Worley had actually gone to be a professor at the University of Southern California the same year I went out. Mm-hmm. And he went to L.A. County. It didn't affect my choice, but it just by coincidence he went to the same place. It was a terrific setup because on the grounds was a small communicable disease hospital, and by law, a whole category of communicable diseases, anywhere diagnosed anywhere in L.A. County, had to go to that hospital. Mm-hmm. So you can see tetanus and all sorts of things that you don't usually see, and a lot of doctors don't see in their life. Right. And so, you know, I'd go on rounds and see a lot of them, take care of a lot of those patients.
Was there anybody else from your medical school class who was internship with you?
Yeah, there were maybe six that went to L.A., some to UCLA, to the Veterans Hospital, and to L.A. County where I was, and we kept close contact all that time.
But this was a big shift from a New York boy moving to
That wasn't so big as, driving across the country.
Well, I was thinking of the climate, but...
Oh, I guess so. It was okay. I didn't pay that much attention. I just worked all the time.
All right. Was there anything other than the infectious diseases hospital that was that you think was particularly important for your later career during that period?
Well, there was, when I was thinking of what I wanted to do, there were, I would say, two major forces. One was my brother, who was 2 years behind me now, even though I was older, because he'd been in the Army for three years. Between his second and third year of Cornell, he wasn't sure what he wanted. He went in the Army. And he, both being mechanical and materialistic, figured out that if three of us, my brother, me, and one of his friends, went into orthopedics, it would be a field he liked because it fit his interests. And we could set up a practice for two. When you figured out all the income tax and everything, take 1 month off a season, and we could go skiing or go to Florida and all of that. So I actually had lined up a fellowship. I wanted to do bone research first and then orthopedics at UCLA. And I thought of that seriously, but never did it. The other thing was there was still a draft. There was a physician draft. The Vietnam War had started with Kennedy, but it was before the period that's now called the Vietnam era. And since I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do as I thought about it, I was going to fulfill my two-year obligation. And I had all the papers to be a flight surgeon. A flight surgeon is basically a family doctor for the Air Force, but you can fly around and see the world. And I thought, well, might as well see the world and enjoy myself. Well, right when I already had the papers, only a couple of days before, and I got this phone call from Paul Worley, the same guy. He had all these connections at CDC, then called the Communicable Disease Center. And he asked if I wouldn't want to go there rather than go to the that counted. It was like the NIH Yellow Berets, CDC,
yes,
same deal.
Yes.
And so I said, okay, I'll come out and look at it. In April, they would have a week where they have the young EIS officers. And so I went there. It looked terrific. And I went to CDC rather than going to the military. And that was a wonderful experience, which we can go through.
And I want to get to that. But just by way of information, did you ever consider the NIH at that point, or did anybody bring it up to you?
No, no one raised it. Never entered my mind. I didn't know anything about NIH. That's
not the only one.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move you to Atlanta from Los Angeles. And you were commissioned as a, what's the first rank? Assistant surgeon, is that?
Oh, yes, assistant surgeon. And they also was a rank equivalent to Navy.
In the Navy, yeah. But I'm thinking of the Public Health Service rank.
Assistant surgeon, I think. Yeah.
And whether I remember the ones mostly from the early 20th century, and they probably changed the names since I did. So at any rate, you arrived in Atlanta, in hot Atlanta, in July 1962. It was probably pretty hot, if I remember. And you were it's very interesting that you were at the CDC from 62 to 64 when I was an undergraduate at Emory.
Okay, but I wasn't there.
But you weren't there.
No.
But did you take the training?
I took the course. So okay. I took the summer course, which Alex Langemeyer was mm-hmm. teaching, and plus the statistician and some other people. The two others, D.A. Henderson was the main one under Alex, and Phil Brockman. So it was like his two deputies, and then there was a statistical group. So they taught us, if you go out and see an epidemic, an outbreak, you know, what do you do? How do you figure out what's going on? And I think ingrained what Alex, who later became a close friend, but what he would call shoe leather epidemiology, you go out there and you deal with it. And I felt, actually, compared to NIH, then I learned a little about NIH, but Alex's view was if someone like a local health commissioner, state health commissioner, city, called up, you sent someone right out, same day or next day, and you let them read about it or call it back if he had a problem and deal with it. And NIH on the infectious disease things would look at it and say, does that fit our interests? And often would not respond. You've sort of got this arrogance feeling.
The NIH was glad when the CDC was created, and it took this off of
well, but
the CDC was dedicated.
It was dedicated to that, and I felt they took the lead for the country on infectious disease away from NIH. That lasted till AIDS came along. And I think it was because of Langemeyer's approach to being responsive, and also I feel that there was an attitude that as an epidemiologist, you're there to figure out and deal with public health problems. That is, it's not just knowing, but it's also the doing part, correcting the problem. And I don't see that here. Frankly, I don't see it in our own.
It's one step removed. You're thinking about it.
It's a little cynical, but it's almost like people think if they retire with a long bibliography, their life was a success, and it's not their responsibility to go beyond publication in a peer-reviewed journal. And the reward system set up for that, for tenure and promotions, you know, what are your publications? The biggest thing.
Several people told me, generally, it's been in the generation before you, but that though there was a major shift in the way people thought about their careers from at NIH, from being public health people primarily to being researchers, academic researchers primarily. And you would agree with that, Ben?
I think so. I don't know a lot about the people here before, except the ones that were more close to my field. But I did sense that, especially when I started at NCI, when we get into that, you'll see, I really felt that, first, Art Upton was director and invited me down to talk, this was 1980, but we'll come back to it, but there was a real issue of anything to do with public service, public health, being pushed aside in the corner and not supported with resources or with encouraging the best people. And I think that problem exists till today.
We will talk more about that.
It's not with all of the institutes, but it is with ours.
All right. So, were there any other people that you met at the when you were in an EIS training that have stayed colleagues and friends and supporters that you specifically
Well, I went from after my medical training to New York State, so there were some people that had been through EIS that came up, and when I first got here, I recruited two from there. So those, the only other ones I really hadn't, Bill Fagey to some extent, and the reason was that Bill Fagey and two other doctors, Pierce Gardner, who's here at the Fogarty, and Ron Roberto, who I think is in a public health position in Berkeley, California. The four of us did this Vanguard study, the smallpox eradication program out in the Tongan Islands.
Yes.
Yeah. So we were there together for 2 or 3 months.
Tell me about that.
Well, the first thing, Ms. Mainly D.A. Henderson's leadership figured out that since smallpox is only acquired and transmitted by people, not animal vectors. And since we had a tremendously effective vaccine, it should be feasible to eradicate it from the world, basically. And so he started thinking in those terms, but there, we had to do some testing. Well, at that time, the Crown Prince of Tonga, Prince Tungi, had come through CDC, this great big, heavy Polynesian fellow, but well-educated from Australia and New Zealand, and felt that it would be good to do a trial in his country because it would help educate his physicians. And this sort of could rationalize it because the next island over, Fiji, had a lot of people that were really immigrants from India and where there was smallpox. Quite a stretch, but they rationalized doing the trial there. And so we set up to test out freeze-dried smallpox vaccine with the idea of finding out if we could reconstitute it, adding water basically, and whether it would still give a take, and then what would the dose be. And we were also testing a modified jet injector gun. The Army had developed this gun where you run electricity, you pull a trigger and it cocks a piston, you pull another and it shoots a thin jet of fluid, so you don't need a needle, and then it injects.
But you have to, if I remember correctly, you have to inject smallpox sort of in the skin.
In and not through. So the nozzle was put at an angle. That was one modification. So you'd get a little bubble like the old TB test. The vaccine would be in the skin, not through, to give better immunity. And the electric part was replaced by a hydraulic foot pedal. So you could cock the piston with no power. And we divided in doses from, if you took the little vial, the drop that people put on here is one, we were testing a tenth, a hundredth, a tenth, a fiftieth, and a hundredth. And then this type where you just scratch through with another method, the older method.
And what did you find?
And we found that with the 150th, there was very, very good immunity. And that you could do freeze-dried, and it was fun. We had generators to show movies to kids that had never seen a movie. We had Polaroid cameras, so they loved it. When I went to a northern island, which means more toward the equator because it was south of the equator, named Vavao, a beautiful volcanic island with a nice harbor, and did that one myself, pretty much. And it all went well, except one lady died. After I left, I didn't find out. You know, after smallpox, you get this open sore in 10 days or so. And she had rubbed dirty leaves, and she got tetanus. She died of tetanus. And then the other interesting story was not the Crown Prince that started it, but his brother, Tui Palahaki, his name was, took one of the two ships owned by the country, kind of a tugboat, and was going up to a little island way to the north called Tin Can Island. It had another name, but it was a little volcanic donut shape with water in the middle, a little. And it was the first time any royalty was going up in 2 years, so they were going to have all these big parties. But he, unlike his brother, was not a great sailor, and he would get seasick. So as they were passing the island where I was, they pulled in, and so I could give him some medicine for seasickness, and which I did. But I said, but we've got to vaccinate up there. So I hopped on the boat with him, went up, and vaccinated them all. He had a son who's 6 years old. He may be current king. I'm not quite sure. I'd have to. But he had this little six-year-old who I played with a lot, and we swam in this volcanic thing. But then after I came back, the trip was over. I should say the reason it was called Tin Can Island, it was sort of a rough edge island, and a boat would go by about once a month, but it wouldn't try to dock because of the shoreline. And the natives would go out with an outrigger canoe, and the mail would be put in a tin can and dropped in the water, and they'd pick it up. So I came back, and I came back to Columbus, Ohio, where I was. Then I saw a little, just a short paragraph, maybe 4 or 5 sentences, Tin Can Island bombed with flu vaccine. Tin Can Island bombed with flu vaccine. So what happened? They didn't have any doctors there, but they had an old retired pharmacist. It seems it was the typical situation of people in an island with no immunity. The six-year-old, I remember, had a cold, and I just could imagine the cold sweeping through the island. And it wasn't flu, I don't believe. It was but a virus, and I could just imagine them blaming it on me giving the vaccine because I got the sore. But when they got in trouble, they would call New Zealand, and the New Zealand, I'm not sure if it was the Air Force or some Coast Guard thing, came and parachuted some flu vaccine down to them, and then they gave it. So that was, I thought, a cute story.
Not that it stopped what was already going it was.
But you know what? There were a lot of other interesting little things that I did in Ohio. The best
when
known.
You come back.
Yeah.
From there. Okay. Let's go to Ohio.
Yeah, it was before.
You were on a permanent assignment then from the CDC to
the Ohio Department of Health in Columbus.
Right.
So there was a Dr. Winslow Bash, B-A-S-H-E, who's a pediatrician who ran communicable disease for the Ohio Department of Health. And later he went to University of Cincinnati as a professor, I think. And then Harold Decker replaced him, both very capable people. And I was good health commissioner there at that time. So I do all these little outbreaks. You okay?
I do fine.
To give some examples. There were polio vaccine was being used. Sabin was out for the first time. And I was working a bit with Robbins, who was at Cleveland Metropolitan Hospital, Fred Robbins, and one of his associates, Martha Liepau, another virologist. I just would help him little studies, like a survey of polio immunity in Cleveland, where we went around and drew blood from 1 to 4-year-olds and knocking on the door. And it was interesting. No problem any place except Shaker Heights, where the mothers wanted to call the doctor. And the trickiest thing was if you couldn't draw it from there, you drew it from their external jugular vein on their neck with their mothers watching. But I did it, and I did actually better than everyone else in getting them to agree, because I was this young doctor. but then there was some vaccine-associated polio. And I remember studying one instance of an 18-month, a year-and-a-half-old kid who lived in an apartment with an adjacent apartment, just sort of catacorner door, was another child who'd been vaccinated. It would have been about 3 weeks before. And then this neighbor got polio but had not been vaccinated. And it seemed obvious to me that the virus had reverted to wild type. The vaccine virus reverted. And these two year-and-a-half-old kids who played together, that one got it from the other, that it passed through his intestine, reverting to wild type. And so I reported it, gave Langmuir all the information. He went to Washington, where he was on a committee that Sabin was on. They had a big fight over it, which Sabin won, but Langmuir wanted to count it as vaccine-associated. Sabin did not want to count it as, you can't blame his great vaccine. So, and that was right after Sabin had published a paper, Cincinnati polio-free for 2 years, and I great.
These nasty little facts.
So that was, another one was, there was an equine influenza, a flu, it was a type A type influenza in horses, that we knew was going to come up from South America to the horse tracks in the United States. So I set up to study whether it would be transmitted to people. So I went to, there's a trotting track south of Columbus, Ohio, named Sciota Downs, S-C-I-O-T-A Downs. And I went out there and I drew blood from the rider, I forget what you call the people that sit in this little cart with two wheels behind the horse, and the grooms and everyone. I took their blood and I swabbed their nose for the virus, and I took blood from the horses with veterinarian's help. And it turned out that there was some influenza, but and many of the men got colds and things, and if you just glanced at it, you might have thought it was the same, but it wasn't. It was probably that the men slept in the barns and things and were close to each other. the horses, some of which came from other tracks and some came off the farms. So, you know, there was some transmission, but it didn't cross species. But the thing that was fun also, because they got to know me, and I said, well, I want to learn to ride one of these things. So a couple of them said, oh, come out at 6 a.m. We'll set you up with a horse and one of these little things. You sit with your feet up, like big wheels on the side and the stride. And they go in the wrong direction because they know that they're just exercising. If they go the other way, they go full speed. So I was out with them, and then they started showing me their tricks. They'd lock their wheel in my wheel. They'd whip my horse with it. It was fun. So, but that, the trotting people were very nice. There were people that liked horses, that took good care of them. You also went to a running track that was terrible. All these bums, they didn't care a damn about the horses. That they had the flu, they put them in anyway because they wanted enough in the race. And in fact, I wasn't a better then, but if you could tell what horse had no chance in the world because they had flu. Then there was a little outbreak in, I think it's called Circleville, a little town south of Columbus, where there was erythema infectiosum, right? It's called the fifth disease, where kids would get a little blotchy rash and a kind of a lace pattern rash. Well, it came out just about the time there was a new toy around called Flubber, sort of a rubbery ball thing that would bounce really high. I think it means flying rubber because they bounce way up. And people were speculating whether this thing was due to the Flubber. And I just plotted how the sales and then the outbreak, and it wasn't due to it. And then I also, because we didn't know then what the cause was, and I trapped some starlings, and then we tried to get, because there was a lot of them with droppings around where some of the kids were, and brought it to a virologist. But it turned out to be the fifth disease, and it helped characterize kind of the age distribution and kind of the spread.
So this is all very, very practical epidemiological shoe leather epidemiology,
right,
where you're out.
Figure it out and then act on it.
And then
act on it is the big thing, yeah.
This is also the period in which you handled the anthrax outbreak that was documented
Bertrand Rouchet.
Bertrand Rouchet's article, let me just get this on the record, A Man Called Hoffman.
Right. Now, the first it was a story in the New Yorker, which in my view was the most accurate of what happened.
Oh, so that it was written by Rouchet or somebody else?
It was written by Bertrand Rouchet. He had something like Medical Detective Series, and that was one of the stories. The first I knew about it, this fellow living between Dayton and Cincinnati had died of anthrax. Anthrax is very easy to diagnose if you see the bacteria. So the Ohio Department of Health lab saw the specimen and said, anthrax. And then I took off to find out what was going on. It turned out that he was an insulation worker, and he'd been working in a hospital putting insulation, which looks like the matting you put under carpets. He was putting this around the pipes, and he had carried the bales on his side, and what we think happened was there was anthrax spores on some old goat hairs that injected right over his neck by the thoracic duct, and he got a very aggressive anthrax and died. Now, the thing was, the company denied, they said all their material was bought in the United States. And I said, let me check all your batches. They had this kind of a storeroom with numbers 303 or 313. Mm-hmm. It's all in that Bertrand Rouchet. And one did not match. And I said, where'd this come from? They went short, and it turned out the supplier had been short, so they bought a different batch that was imported from the Middle East through New York and New Jersey, and so I thought just from the study that that's where it was, and I pulled out some specimens from the insulation and brought it back, and that I did that in a day. It didn't take me that long. And that was just before I took off for the Tongan Islands on the smallpox. So I never saw Rouchet, but I wrote all this up. And then Phil Brockman came up, who felt he was an anthrax expert, and he actually I thought, tried to get a lot of the glory in the pretend that I was this young person that had never seen anthrax, but I'd seen anthrax in Iran before. But he, Bachman did do, I mean, he didn't help with uncovering it, but he did do a follow-up that was quite useful. One, the spores, it was proven that it was anthrax, and then he went to, I'm not sure, I think it was New Jersey, where they were importing this, and got the rules changed so that, because people were using brushes for shaving and different things that had, and the rules were changed so you had to do something that would kill the anthrax spores and were more protective about what was being imported. And then I felt that when they got to the book, there was just a slight change that kind of gave a little more glory to Phil, but that was petty. I mean, he did deserve some credit for it.
I remember reading it and thinking, Peter sounds almost like the hired help here.
Yeah,
I understood he did more of
that. That was nonsense. I actually had it all written up, which tickled the Ohio Department of Health people, because Brockman came up and I handed them the whole report with the answer and the analysis. And, you know, he thought he was going to come in to show us. So there was just a little feeling of, you know, one-upsmanship or stuff that was mostly from him, I felt, because I, you know, was just a young person doing it.
Yes, that was the other thing that I could see. You were the young person, and you could step aside and let the older man take the credit. That's, yes, okay. After this, you, from 64 to 66, you did a residency at Tufts.
Right.
Tell me about the field that was in, and if that, what kind of influence that might have had.
Well, it was really at Boston City Hospital.
Okay.
Boston City Hospital had three services at that time: Harvard, Tufts, and Boston University. So the three medical schools kind of divvied up the wards with some training, cross training. So I took neurology and hematology. No, neurology and with the Harvard group. So you'd switch, but it was like LA County, not quite as wild, but with very good academic training. And I was then taking training in internal medicine, so a lot of cardiology, probably more cardiology than oncology by far, a lot of advanced patients. You saw a lot, so you learned how to deal with it. The head of medicine there at Tufts, Biguria, Fernando Biguria was his name, was an old-time doctor who was great at medical history, diagnosing, seeing all these kinds of patients. And you weren't learning lab first, but you were learning diagnosis, careful attention to the patient, what they're saying, what they look like first. So that was good. And I particularly liked the hematology. There was a Jane DeForge who would send prominent as an editorial deputy editor in the New England Journal was there. There were good kidney people. Arnold Rellman was one who later gave me my orals on my board exam, which was kind of funny because they let me do it at Boston City, and I knew that kind of patient, so it was a snap. A lot of people, if they see multiple systems, it's a little harder, but if you have a lot of experience with it, somehow.
Right. So,
the one thing that struck me was all the other residents had straight medicine internships, and I had this rotating one, and I had CDC, and it didn't make any difference. I think I was better off having all the surgical and other things than just going straight medicine.
I was also very interested in the health project, the student health project at the University of Southern California. Now, tell me how this worked in
for two summers. Because after my 2 years of internal medicine training, I had a choice of being a chief resident, which would be learning to be an administrator, mm-hmm. maybe if I wanted to be a medical person at a university. And I decided I didn't want to do that. I was going to go and get a master's degree in public health and epidemiology at Harvard. I was accepted. But there was a difference in the time. The residency ended June 30th, and the master's program started in September, so I had the summer off. And so again, go back to Paul Worley, he knew that I was going to be free. And I had plans to go rafting down the Colorado River, which he also knew. and he called up some students starting in California had on their own started the Student Health Project, which was kind of go out in areas with poor groups or community groups and sort of do what you can to do some good as young medical students. And Paul was their faculty mentor responsible for it, but he wanted me to come and actually do that for him. Uh-huh. So he said, why don't you forget about rafting, spend your summer out here. So I did. So the first summer in LA, and the second was is at Menlo Park, right next to Stanford. And the students, some would be out with the migrant workers, some would be in Watts, some would be other places, helping run clinics or get patients in. The second year especially, there were some out in Haight-Ashbury because there was LSD and all the druggies were coming on, and I'd oversee them, and some in East Palo Alto, which was the poor black area. Mm-hmm. Some also out in the valley from there. The biggest thing was all these kids on drugs and being wild. Mostly they had colds and cuts on their feet for going barefoot. Mm-hmm. Some were being detoxified, but the students did it themselves. They'd set up a room in Haight-Ashbury, remember, with they just had mattresses around it, and they'd just stay with them until they got over it. They didn't give them anything, but it worked. It wasn't any big thing in my career, but I was kind of, it was interesting. And
it resulted in a publication then.
I don't know. There's a little book of all their reports, but I don't know that it ever really got published where you could retrieve it. There was a sort of a fat book. I don't know if I have a book.
I have one like that, too.
Yeah, but it really didn't get published where you can go someplace to a library and find it, I don't think. But it was published.
But it was published, yes. So in 1967, then, you go to Harvard to work on a Master's of Public Health in Epidemiology. Now, this is something we've talked about before, but I'm going to ask you to explain it for the record here. You encountered a whole new way to think about epidemiology.
Yes.
The Harvard approach was very different from the CDC approach.
Right.
Tell me about it.
Right. And with two giants in the field of epidemiology, Alex Langmuir, who made CDC from a sleepy malaria agency to a world-leading epidemiology infectious disease, and Brian McMahon, who was a very rigorous evidence-based scientist in epidemiology. I went having this, what Langmuir would call shoe leather. You figure out what's going on, and you figure out what to do about it, and you take responsibility to follow through. And I went to Brian McMahon then and said, I've been an EIS officer, do I have to take the basic epidemiology course? And he smiled, very nice, sort of quiet, a little bit introverted guy, but very, very nice. He says, you not only have to take it, you've been brainwashed. You have to be deprogrammed and now learn epidemiology. He said, CDC has a very good program. The only problem with it is people come out thinking they know epidemiology. So I signed up and took it. And actually, he was right in the sense that I didn't know his approach, which was very analytical. How do you set up comparisons and case control studies? How do you do cohort studies? What are the statistical methods linked to that? How do you use big data sets? We had to learn programming at that time. And he had written this textbook of epidemiology, which described that approach. And for the sort of people you see at NIH, I mean, the best people in the country, a lot of them were almost like Brian McMahon's Alumni Association. I mean,
such as.
He trained a huge, Joe Framini, Bob Hoover, Dave Schottenfeld, they're all over the place. If you go to a cancer meeting of epidemiology, or if you did 10 or 15 years ago, more than now, the heads of departments really had gone through either that program or Johns Hopkins with Abe Lilienfeld. They were the two big, strong programs. And they didn't always agree with, but I also actually had close ties with Lilienfeld, although I never trained there. I don't remember how it started. I think it first was when I was in first went to New York State. This was after that. I didn't know anything about NIH, as you know, and a fellow in Buffalo named Saxon Graham, a sociologist who was doing cancer epidemiology, said to me, "Why don't you apply for a grant?" I hadn't ever applied for a grant. No, I was on McMahon's teaching grant, I think, but I didn't know anything about it. They just paid me a little bit. And so I got an application, I looked at it, and I applied for this great big program project grant. A lot of different studies, all sorts of things, and tracking down Hodgkin's and other things, and a whole lot. And then, so there was a site visit, and I think Abe Lilienfeld chaired it. It was wonderful. They came in, and they sort of gave me an education about, well, oh yeah, that's a good way of doing this. Have you thought of doing it a little bit this way and that kind of things? And I got a great score and got this great big grant. And then actually, several years later, it was time to renew. And I wasn't, So it was very constructive. And when it came time for renewal, I was concerned that all these people I'd put on the grant were leaving me with the burden. So I said, we're not going to reapply. We're going to have multiple R01s out of phase. And actually, by the time I came here, I had what I thought was a small program in epidemiology, but it was about $7 million a year from 12 different sources. And when you have that many sources, you can do whatever you want. So there it was really nice. The other big thing with Lilienfeld that happened, I had looked at the pattern of brain tumors across upstate New York. And in Monroe County, where Rochester is, it was higher. So I went out to figure out what was going on. And there were more in the Eastman Kodak workers. Kodak has a huge plant there. So I linked up, what's his last name? Barry. I should remember his name. It happened in one of the papers. But I linked up with the epidemiologist at Kodak, who was excellent and trained with Hopkins. And we laid out a plan to do a joint study of brain tumors in Monroe County and at Kodak. And we decided that it would be smart to have an independent referee to make sure, you know, that it was well done and that nobody could say company bias, government bias. And that was Abe Lilienfeld. We asked him, and he said, sure. Barry Harris. And then what happened was it turned out there were more diagnoses of brain tumors. They were not in the chemists, even though we had found all the old timers to figure out exposure. They were in office workers and others. And we had only a control group of other workers who didn't have it, but we got a positive control group of people from the community that had brain tumors that were not COVID. And it turned out that the Kodak people just tended to have better care. They'd have better diagnostic tests. And that was before CT scans. And we ended up just thinking, well, probably in the over 65 group, hidden in strokes and things were some brain tumors that weren't found if someone went to a nursing home or went, you know, or was out. And it was just better medical practice. And so we published that. And Lilienfeld looked at it and actually thought the idea of a positive control was clever. But he was very helpful and very friendly. And ever since, when I'd go to some sort of meetings, I'd get invited almost like it was an alumnus of Hopkins, but I never really was there. And they wanted me to come there before I came here. But.
Well, if I am correct, also during your time at Harvard is when you met Harriet.
Right.
And you two married in 68, And that it's a wonderful story about how you met Harriet. You want to tell that story from a personal side.
Well, that was funny because at our daughter Laura's wedding, her husband, Ian Farmer, had worked with James York, who's an originator of the chaos theory, an architect, a chief architect. And a lot of this is like my sort of naive version of chaos theory, where a small event has a big impact down the road, although this is a big impact. So I was there living in Boston and Brookline. Harriet was living in Cambridge. And I was bored one day. So because I was bored, I went to a party in Cambridge. And Harriet was there, and not smoking, although I guess she occasionally smoked. I probably wouldn't have talked to her if she had been. But that's when we met. And so actually, I said at Laura's wedding, I think, that, you know, because I was bored once in 1967, I went to this wedding, and that was the cause of Laura's marriage.
Right.
Yeah. But it was just a sort of a coincidence. We met at a party,
Well, Harriet was a graduate student in colonial American history, if I recall.
Yes, she was colonial American history with some good historians, excellent historians.
Bernard Bailyn
was one. I think she was a little overwhelmed when she came from UCLA to Harvard with these sort
of... Well, she came at a time when very few women were...
Yeah, well, she certainly had the brains for it, but I think, you know, some of the way that...
It was a hard track to go through. People were not real pleased to see you taking the place a man might have. All right. What I also see is 1968, from looking at your CV and what have you, is sort of a definite turning point in your career, not only personally, but that's when you begin to shift from being trained to being a full-time leader. Would you view this as the point at which you were shifting gears?
My choice then was, did I want to stay at Harvard, which McMahon wanted, but I had a superb class, about six of us, that were very good in the field in McMahon-type epidemiology. Phil Cole was one. There were a few. They were really outstanding. But, you know, it looked like it would be a long path and I'd be an academic at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And I was never that impressed with the glory of being at a prestigious university. I mean, other people might be, but I didn't care that much about it.
What did you really want to do?
And I wanted to go to a place where I could do both the Langmuir type and the McMahon type. Mm-hmm. And people in the New York State Department of Health somehow knew about me and were calling me, and others, people were recruiting. But that looked like a situation where they had a state cancer registry, an old, well-established one, and you could step back and say, look, I'm New York State, I can do these population studies, the main type. And you also could do things more or less like I'd done in Ohio, where you could go out and figure out what's going on and you could implement your actions. And also the salary, which at that point I think was $25,000 a year, but that was a good salary at that point.
Oh, yes.
So I decided, in spite of McMahon, I would go to New York State and on my own and run a department. And so I went there to do cancer control.
While we are doing this, let's take one more little sidestep and talk about your philosophy of medicine and what for you made medicine and being a doctor important in as your life's work.
I think I was getting more and more of a belief that I could be a good internist, but there were lots and lots of them, and I'd just be one more doctor seeing patients. It's rewarding. I like doing clinical medicine. But I thought public health could have the bigger impact and was very thin in depth of good people. It wasn't valued as much because acute things get more attention. And so I was going more and more toward public health and particularly prevention. One example of applications early on, we did a little study of cancer of the cervix and found that of the women dying of cancer of the cervix, a lot of them had been in the hospital in an emergency room within a few years before, I forgot, 2 or 3 years before, we did not have a Pap test, and their deaths might have been avoided.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the health commissioner to write a letter to all the hospitals in the state saying, from now on, I think we got it in the law, I forgot, but if a person comes in, she gets a Pap test, or unless there's a medical reason not to, and we're going to come around, I think it was in 6 months, and check on it. And if you're not doing it, you can be fined $1,000 per woman who wasn't tested. So we put this out, and then the time came around, and I had promised that we'd be around to check. So I wasn't sure what to do, so I said, okay, to my staff, we're all taking off. We're going to visit every hospital in New York State in a week, and we're going to look. So, and I estimated 75 deaths per year could be prevented if doctors did this, based on this analysis. Well, we did that, and what was interesting was our reception was very different than it was when we would do our studies. You do our studies, and you get stuck in the corner by the records room clerk or something, and they'd let you do what you wanted. Now we had the red carpets rolled out, the hospital head was there, and a lot of the hospitals had changed. The big thing was one of two things. Either they had required the face sheet to include Pap test done or not mm-hmm. indicated, which you had to fill out before you could get paid for the hospitalization. Or they had a doctor who was a medical leader, maybe who was a strong personality in that hospital, said, we're going to do it, and made sure that they set up an arrangement. So those were, and often was the Catholic hospital seemed to be the best, but that's just an impression. I didn't really.
Anyways, but the reward system for the hospital to be able to say, we have lowered deaths, our deaths.
You would think so. But so that worked, but I never really had a long term follow up, so I didn't do a really long term. But for a period, it certainly worked.
When you first went to New York State, I believe that your job description, and maybe the title, was broader than, you seem to have narrowed down more towards cancer as time went on, but you were doing...
It started more with cancer.
It started
and then there was a cancer registry and not a lot else, and then I built it into a research and applied program. Then I took epidemiology was higher over more than just cancer, included cancer, infectious disease, like a mini CDC, heart disease, some little neurologic disease. And so I went up to be over all of them as head of epidemiology, which included cancer control, so-called, but included all the infectious disease. But I usually had another physician under me, like Don Lyman, who's now sort of second under the director in California Department of Public Health, or Al Hinman, who was at CDC for a long time. They would run the infectious disease part. Although they would report to me, they pretty much did that themselves.
So it went the other way then. It started more narrowly and became broader as time goes on.
Right.
I noted one of your early studies, which was an Atomic Energy Commission monograph, The Relation of Radioactive Fallout to Leukemia and Fetal Mortality. Tell me about that study.
There, I think this is one you're referring to. There was a physicist, or is up there, named Ernest Sternglass at Pittsburgh, who, in my view, was a bit of an alarmist about radiation. Not that radiation can't be a problem, but there were all these camps where people would push it as if it's a problem and try and be very selective in what they chose to highlight. And he had identified an atomic bomb test. I'm not sure if it was, I think it was New Mexico, not Arizona, but where in some of the radiation blew over the all Albany-Troy area, and that was documented by RPI people, that there was some fallout. And then he claimed that there was more leukemia in Albany right in that period, and more birth defects that were due to the radiation. Mm-hmm. So with the statistician, I think her name was Sandy Kitchen, I studied it, and she helped me analyze it. We pulled all the cases, and it fell apart. So basically, I don't remember exactly, I think there were 5 leukemia patients. One woman had a cesarean. We couldn't tell if she had x-rays before. There were a couple that were not born that year or were not born in that area, and he was attributing it to prenatal exposure. Uh-huh. So it was impossible because they weren't there, mm-hmm. or it was the wrong time. And so you ended up with the same or fewer cases than you would expect by the normal occurrence rate. And then on I think it was fetal deaths. All we did was separate New York City from upstate, and all the excess was in New York City, and he was talking about Albany. So it was just nonsense. And so we published it.
I find it very interesting. A number of these studies that you are sometimes confirming what things have been caused, and other times you're showing that no, you're refuting the fear. And this has been a task of public health epidemiologists, which doesn't always make them popular.
That's true, and I think, unfortunately, now there's such an army with such where their aim is publish, 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 and there's so many journals that there's a lot of flimsy work as well as rigorous work. Mm-hmm. And you end up with people spending time resetting things that were not well studied, or were there false alarms, or maybe false safety, but more often false alarms, because that's picked up.
Yeah.
And it relates to people, so the press picks it up, and you have an issue. The current one is cell phones. Right?
Yes.
And I don't believe there's
and
evidence.
And high energy lines, too.
High energy is tougher. There was a point when I was in New York State when the power companies wanted us to study high energy lines. And the reason was it cost them a lot because they needed wider right away and they needed to put the poles higher for these high tension electric mm-hmm. power lines. And they wondered if they could make it narrower or lower. And so I looked at it and just decided there just were not enough populations close enough in that you could get a reasonable measurement and set up a decent epidemiologic study. And on top of that, one of the questions was circadian rhythms of sleep patterns, and there's no way to get a real handle on what was going on. So I just said, sorry, study some mice if you want, but we're not going to study it because we didn't have a sound way of doing the study.
Which is another thing. So in October 68, I see that, it may have been before, but your title was Director of Cancer Control, the Cancer Control Bureau. And this was a position you held in for 10 years. And what I want you to do is to explain to me now, for the record, what the difference between cancer control and cancer prevention is.
If you look at the way NCI was defining it during that period, cancer control was set into law in 1973. The National Cancer Act was 1971. And then there were people like Lester Breslow, an outstanding public health person from California. He was head of the health department for the state, and he was dean of the School of Public Health at UCLA. He's still very active in age 92 or so. But cancer control was defined into law because of a concern by Congress that NCI would never do things that help the public. They would just do the research under the National Cancer Act. And they set up this and set a sequence of $10, $20, $30 million over 3 years to do cancer control. But they didn't define it that well either, except that it was supposed to be some sort of community activity to benefit the public. During that 10 years, this decade of the 70s, here at NCI, it was interpreted as defining out any research. And they would sit around the table and say, what should we do? And give money to things, often kind of public education efforts.
Stop smoking efforts,
but it wasn't soundly anchored in research to see if it was effective or efficient or the best way to go about it. And that's what I changed when I came here. Mm-hmm. And I never accepted that idea. I always felt you link research and research on applications and efficacy, which is sort of in a clinical trial, can you prove something works, or in a tight scientific study, and effectiveness is, do you have an impact of benefit to a population over a defined population?
But the cancer control at that time was also, it was not giving money for things like radiation implants so that hospitals
there were people. What happened here was people would want money for something and they'd say, that's cancer control, so we're going to define it in. And the big thing defined in was rehabilitation, which some surgeons put in. So there's that one more right side. So people then for a while were saying cancer control and rehabilitation and using the cancer control funds for that. And there was also a set-aside for a long time, which was sheltered for extramural applied efforts. And now they got very muddled under Klausner, especially. They wanted to just say, why should we have more than one budget? And NIH this year took it out because NIH couldn't see why NCI should have a special category when no other institute does. And it makes it a little awkward in the way they set out their budgets. But it lessens the flexibility to control the money.
Well, in this period then, cancer control was a vaguely defined...
It was vague.
And was cancer prevention talked about separately, or was that...
If you were here, for example, there was a division of cancer cause and prevention before I came, till I got that changed. I'll tell you why, because I was in prevention in my division. Prevention was... to me, falsely defined as anything to do with studying causality, etiology, and epidemiology, with nothing that involves intervening. So to me, etiology is to know something, and prevention is to do something, to bring down risk. And it never had the do something in it, so people were lying, I thought, when they were saying prevention, because they weren't doing anything. They were just trying to find out cause, and they'd say, well, until we know everything, the mechanism and everything, which could be never, we're not going to do prevention. And it was an excuse to just do research on causality. And not that that's important, but that's not prevention to me. They're linked, but...
Yes, no,
not prevention.
No, I think it's very important that you set this out.
You have to intervene for it to be prevention. That was my view.
Okay. So let's go back to New York now, and then we'll come back. But that was very important, and I'm glad to get that, because I was confused. One of the first articles that you published in New York had to do with the need for stricter legislation to control tobacco and cigarette advertising in response to the expiration of the health warning label on cigarette packages, which was going to occur July 1st, 1969. I found it very interesting in reading the papers about the different involvement of the Federal Trade Commission and the Food and Drug Administration and the anti-tobacco lobby and the pro-tobacco lobby at this time. Tell me what was going on here from your perspective in New York.
Okay. In New York was a little different than when I got here, so I can explain them both, but... Basically, it was obvious that a big cause of lung cancer and other cancers was tobacco use. And so we did what we could do in public education. The first thing I did was actually, I was still in Boston knowing I was going to New York, and there was a good health educator there. I wanted to keep him busy. So I suggested to her that she get spouses, mostly wives of doctors all over the state, to do a little education program and get them involved in their communities. Our feeling was, at that point, that the federal government was never going to do it. They were so controlled by tobacco lobbyists that you would not get meaningful policy legislation, and that it would better do it from bottom up to get communities and state and things to start educating school children, all the different things. And it was mostly an education effort.
Yes, okay.
So that was the main thing. Also, I was against the safer cigarette because I thought it was a fraud. Even then it was known from Winders groups and others that you could put in a filter, but because the way the holes were put in things, you'd get just as much tobacco, or people would inhale more or do something.
Well, in all this work that you were doing here also, you talk about that it's important in one of your articles for physicians to give forceful advice to their patients. Right. What could physicians do in 1971 to help patients quit beyond urging them?
I think the main things were pretty simple. One, ask people if they want to quit. And even then, many people wanted to quit. In fact, the peak and drop in smoking started in the 60s, even though the change in lung cancer didn't come till later. So if you just say, have you thought about not smoking? A lot of people would like to, and they have trouble doing it. Then give them a strong message. As your physician, I have to advise you. You should stop smoking. It's bad for your health for many reasons. But then follow up. If your nurse calls you back in a few days or say, next time you come in, I want you to tell me what you've done. I'm going to write in your record that we talked about it. And so I think the main thing was to say, as your physician, I feel it's important. If you have an interest, you should do something. Now, I there were things more or less like what I'm saying that got more codified over time. And I'm not sure I'm saying it exactly the way I said it at that time, but it's more or less along those lines.
No, I guess what I'm getting at is that there really was no other method like now with the chewing gum and the patches and all these things to think of it as an addiction.
No, I don't think so. But what I described is one part. The other part was that it was clear that the physicians treating cancer patients for most of the counties and cities in New York State were the ones looked to for American Cancer Society policies and other things. And as community leaders, I would encourage them, and I'd work with the Cancer Society to do this, to say, speak out, get your school system work. You know, you're a community leader. People look up to you as a doctor. Take some responsibility. And some did. I mean, some were quite good, and lots of others said, it's not my role.
Oh, it is. I was quite interested in looking at the different kinds of cancers that you studied over the course of your years in New York. And there was a most interesting study in 71, papers describing what looked like a cluster of Hodgkin's disease. Now, I remembered that there had been at least a suggestion that Epstein-Barr virus was connected to Hodgkin's, but it appears that you didn't find this. Tell me about this whole thing.
Well, there were different things we were looking at. One was, it was rare under age 10 for children to get Hodgkin's. And we thought it could be immunity issue, and that was the time the tonsils would shrink. So we related tonsillectomy to risk. I don't know if it's true or not. It looked that way as an association. There was a group at Yale that was looking at EB virus. Evans, I believe, was it. The virologist. We then also had this large cluster. I'm not sure the year. It might have been after that. Where a lot of students from a class of Albany High School, but not only in the class, but if you did a network of acquaintance networks, it looked like a pattern a bit reminiscent of infectious disease spread, where it would be, we were thinking more or less like polio, where a couple of hundred might get exposed and only one would become ill, where it was a rare manifestation of a common exposure of some virus. I was actually seeing patients of Kennels and John Horton later, the heads of oncology at Albany Medical School. I go and see their patients with them and give them their drugs sometimes. But the main layer was trying to culture viruses out of their throat.
This was the whole time of looking for virus, this connection to cancer, wasn't it?
Yeah, or even before that with Huebner, yes. But Huebner, even, he was very active in that period and sort of the leader in looking for viruses here. And I met him out at USC when we had one of our this publication in the school. They wanted to know who is this guy up in Albany and what's the evidence. So Brian Henderson, who was at USC then and had worked at CDC and I think with Huber, I'm not sure, but now he's dean at USC. But they invited me out to present what we were doing, and I went and did it. Our problem, I think, in retrospect, was that I culture the throats of the patients and their family members and things and bring them back to our lab. But our lab, New York State Health Department lab, which is good quality, but they only had competency for DNA viruses, not the RNA. The methods weren't. In fact, I think nobody, even now, if you look at, say, hepatitis C vaccine, where hepatitis C is an RNA virus. We don't have the vaccine yet. Hepatitis B, where it's a DNA virus, easier problem. There is a vaccine. So you know, we looked and looked, but we didn't isolate any viruses.
It's very
and
interesting.
All we had were these patterns that were suggestive associations, and you couldn't really confirm it.
One sees all the different things developing and knowledge. The molecular revolution was just beginning at that point. In 1974, you finished up your doctoral dissertation with a dissertation on the epidemiology of prostate cancer. Did this research teach you any particular thing that we should know?
Well, it was more just the results of the studies. I mean, it was using the methods that McMahon would tend to use. It was basically two studies. I could have probably finished a lot earlier, but I already was an MD. It wasn't any rush to get my PhD. I actually brought it back with me and was doing this job and finally had some other people on my staff work with me just to get it over with. But it was a, we'd call it a retrospective cohort study of people with enlarged prostates to see if that predisposed to prostate cancer. And I was using people from the from the Leahy Clinic in Boston, where I got their old records, and then I traced them to the present compared to controls, and it did not show an association. One of the hardest things was they called me, "What do you want this record for?" I said, "I'm doing this study." "Well, why did you want this record? It's locked up." "Well, it was Joe Kennedy." And then the other one was, ignore it, I'll call it. With breast cancer, age at first childhood was known to affect risk, early age, lower risk. And we had no way of getting a handle on that with prostate cancer, so I wanted to look at physical features, hair pattern, muscular maleness patterns. And I worked with a guy named Al Damian, an anthropologist, who was working with a whole data set from the early 1900s of Harvard grads. He also had Pennsylvania, but I only worked at Harvard. And they had, anthropologists had examined all the Harvard students, all the men with nude photos, ranked them with these somatotype scales and androgyny and different scales of maleness and femaleness, pattern of hair on your back, all this stuff. And so I wanted to see if that would relate to prostate cancer risk. We also had the 25th anniversary picture of baldness. Thinking, well, if there was something going on during your teenage years or your 20s or so, this might give us a hint, because we had no way to get a handle on it. And the study was well done, but it didn't really show.
But what I'm seeing is the pattern over this period in New York, in your career, of all these different experiences, so that
right.
you were getting a great depth of experience in an awful lot of cancers and how
right.
you could
it
study
was wide in scope. And people here don't know, but a lot was in infectious disease, heart disease. I didn't work as much directly, but I was overseeing it all. Multiple sclerosis studies.
But one of the things that struck me was that you wrote a chapter in a book that was, I guess, a tribute to Edward Seidenstricker.
Oh, yes, right.
And, of course, he was a pioneering statistical
right.
epidemiologist
right.
here at the NIH. And I just wondered what drew you to Seidenstricker. How did you end up writing that article? And
I don't know. There was this Milbank Memorial Fund that wanted to write a volume, a book, dedicated to Seidenstricker's life. Seidenstricker had worked in a county in upstate New York near Binghamton. And so I think that's probably why they got in touch with me. I agreed to do it, but then there was another older doctor there, Robert Korn, who I think he was born as to a missionary in China and knew about Pearl Buck, knew about Seidenstricker, and he wanted to take part with me. So he worked, he sort of volunteered, and I said, sure. So what we did was, we looked at this county where there had been TB programs that Seidenstricker had developed and published, I think about 1925, where what was known for TB control was instituted, and a lot was kind of engineering, sort of. And then we compared it to other counties and looked at what happened subsequently, whether the TB control programs had really made a difference. And even though they were state-of-the-art for that time, it turned out that they didn't, that the overall time trend, the secular trend of TB going down just masked anything probably. You know, if there was an effect, TB was going down everywhere, and you couldn't say this program that was well done in, I think it's Broome County, in the county with Binghamton or around that area, whether that program made a difference. And it was something Seidenstricker had worked on, and so as we wrote a bit about him, and we sort of highlighted that story because nobody had ever actually done a follow-up from that period, so we just did it through records of the New York State Department of Health.
In 1978, you won the Redway Medal, an award for medical writing given by the New York State Journal of Medicine. Tell me about what this particularly was for.
There was a peak, a little epidemic of cancer of the endometrium during the 70s that was due to hormone use. And we had shown the pattern and the description and wrote a story about it in the New York State Journal of Medicine. Because I tended to write to that journal a lot because it reached all the licensed doctors in New York State, and that was my target audience. So I wasn't looking at New England Journal's famous. I was looking at how am I going to reach the doctors of New York State. So I'd write there, and that was out of the blue. I don't know. I didn't know there was a Red White Medal, but they said, oh, congratulations.
I was just curious. It was,
a good paper that was practical because it had to do with effects of hormone use and whether you're giving too big a dose. And,
As we come to the end of today's session, there are a couple of things. I noted that you were on, you obviously were getting somewhat involved with NIH because when you sat on a study section from 74
right.
to 78, and in 79, the Surgeon General published the first book which provided nutrition advice, the first study, which becomes one of your fields. And it was sometime around this point in 79 when, as I understand it, Arthur Upton approached you about coming down
right,
here.
Right.
You want to tell me about all this?
Let me do both. First of all, being on the study section, epidemiology and disease control, was a wonderful experience. We look at grants and we do site visits. Some of them at that time we try to be constructive to promising people, not just knock them. But you really learned about what it takes to write a good grant application and how they're evaluated, and you looked at things you might not have looked at somebody else's work. And so I think that kind of training is good for many young scientists and people coming along. So those 4 years I really valued as that experience. The Art Upton was a wonderful person, very kind. I think he hated being NCI director. That he wasn't the type that, you know, he was a wonderful radiation biologist, but to be the one to tell people no or sorry or, you know, stand up to Congress who's grandstanding on something that he knew was funny, he just didn't like it.
Yeah, he had a habit of getting people to be director that really don't want to be.
So for making tough decisions that are unpleasant, I just don't think he liked it. So anyway, he had been in New York State and connected with NYU in a place they had in Rockland County, in Orange County. And he invited me down really to shape up cancer control and prevention. And I talked to him for a whole afternoon, maybe 3 or 4 hours, about what I thought we ought to do. And he'd nod and be very pleasant and sketch on the board, maybe twice. And then he'd try to contact me. But he wanted me to come down, but I never got the sense that he had the strength of management leadership and then where he would let me do what I felt I needed to do to turn things around here. And one thing that actually annoyed me was he had set up a committee to look at what should be done in cancer control. I don't remember the years, but Bob Hoover chaired it or co-chaired it. And what they had done was taken everything that nobody wanted and the people that nobody wanted and put them in a division with a really bureaucratic name, Division of Resources, Centers, and Community Activities. Mm-hmm. We're called DRACA, Division of Resources, Centers, and Community Activities. And that was the division. Upton wanted me to run it. And I might have considered it if I knew that I would have the backing, not in intent, but in the resource allocation and decision making that would let me change things. And so I declined. I just didn't feel that I would be able to do the job, even though I liked the opportunity. When Vince DeVita came, he started as director just a couple of months before me. He'd been head of the Division of Cancer Treatment. I had a very different picture. I had the picture of a strong manager that had no problem saying, here's what I think and we're going to do it. And so I went over things with Vince. It was clear, I thought, that he's going to back me up and let us make changes. And he did when I came down. For example, we had a staff of about 100. Mm-hmm. I pared it down to 40. Because I'd call people in and say, you know, what are you doing? What do you expect to accomplish over the next year? Let's spell it out. You're accountable for that. Some would leave or retire or things. And then there was an issue over the name. I said, I want the name changed. I want it to be called Division of Cancer Prevention and Control. Well, there was a Division of Cause and Prevention, which Dick Adams said was so a good man, but you couldn't have two divisions with the word prevention in. So we went through some debates, including at executive committee retreats, and Vince made Dick change the name of his division. So it became Division of Cancer Etiology, which was more accurate. And Dick was okay. I mean, he went along with it, and we were good friends. So I got what I wanted, and then we built it up. We went up to maybe 200 people, and a strong program.
And that's where we're going to start.
We put science into it, which was a big thing. And how we did that is probably part of the story.
And that's where we're going to start the next time. And I'm going to say thank you at this point.
Okay, well, thank you.
Let's do that.